Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, the anti-theme of American Variety has always been anything but politics. And along with that, I've always avoided religion and sports. In other words, areas that are emotional hot buttons or where you're expected or forced to take sides. I don't tend to see things in black and white, and I sure don't like the heated arguments that those topics lead to. So a while back, when a publicist sent me a new book entitled The Power of Sports, Media and Spectacle in American Culture, I thanked him and left it sitting on a shelf for a few months, and I kind of figured it was an enthusiastic encomium about the wonderfulness of sports. But when I finally did pick it up, I was surprised. The book is an in-depth, well-researched, really a tour de force looking at the many ways in which the modern sports industry shapes our culture and is shaped by it. So it's packed full of persuasive facts and quotes by people who live in and around the world of organized sports and is a very interesting read. It would have to be to engage someone like me who's a fisherman and a hiker and doesn't really care about team sports. Used to be a surfer when I lived somewhere else besides the mountains. The book's author is Dr. Michael Serrazio, a professor of communications at Boston College, who specializes in media production, advertising, and popular culture. He's joining us today from Boston. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks very much for having me, Court, and thank you for the very kind words about the book. I appreciate that.
Well, I thank you for being on. I appreciate you being with us today. So without giving away too much of our show right at the outset, Michael, I'll say that the basic premise of your book, it seems to me, to be that organized, commercialized team sports such as basketball and baseball, but especially football, are kind of atavistic throwbacks to a time when men and maleness were totally dominant, a kind of practice for warfare, and that they're out of place in 21st century society. And the book describes how the players maintain this extreme maleness and are aided and abetted in it by the media, while at the same time the whole giant enterprise, audiences and players alike, are manipulated by team owners and corporations to maximize profits. So the book comes at these concepts from many directions and makes a strong case that this needs to change. So is that a fair assessment of your book, or is it too black and white?
Well, I think anytime you've got a project of this length, and I was hoping to engage a number of different angles and issues and topics and fronts, you know, it can be read in many different directions. But I think absolutely, yeah, I think that, you know, what you've captured there in that synopsis is very much what I was trying to get at with the book, which is to say that the book is really an attempt to understand American culture through the lens of sports. Because that topic, American culture, is so huge and unwieldy, that means many different things. I mean, that has relevance to how gender is lived. That has relevance to our political ideologies. Certainly has relevance to the impact of the media on our culture. And so with all of those different sort of angles, I was hoping to be able to use sports as really a mirror to sort of understand how it is that American culture is at this transformative moment where things are changing dramatically, certainly in terms of gender and masculinity, as you mentioned a second ago, but also very much in terms of the media ecosystem as well. And it's a book about sports, but it's only a book about sports as a way of understanding these other far more important topics and issues.
Yes, as you said, Michael, sports do play a really important role in our culture. You know, as I said, I'm not a team sports fan, and I seldom even watch team sports, but I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate in a few ways here and there. Sure. Throughout our interview. And I think, like it or not, I think it's a question of whether there should be some, let's call them islands of testosterone-driven activity left in our culture, or whether everything should be civilized and therefore, let's say, feminized, as has happened in most other public areas of life. I think that eliminating all such outlets for aggression really produces in part the backlashes we see against minorities and immigrants and Muslims and gays and women and liberals and the media and so on. You know, basically, in other words, I think everything you assert in the book is true, but I disagree with the premise that it should be otherwise. To put it bluntly, for example, I think that if we didn't have football, we'd have even more mass shootings than we already have. So what do you think about all that?
It's an important question, and it is something that media research has been trying to suss out for 100 years, very much more broadly than simply sports itself, right? Well, frankly, it's not just media research that's been trying to suss this out. You can go back 2,000 years to the ancient Greeks and their development of the notion of catharsis. This notion that by viewing dramatic tension on the stage, subsequently, you know, sort of violent imagery in the media, that that somehow cleanses us of our aggression, that somehow purifies us of our emotions, and that we're going to be somehow safer as people in our everyday lives because we're able to view on the screen this violence, whether it be action adventure movies or Sunday afternoons with the NFL. The history of that research is like many forms of social science, which is to say that the answer is, well, it depends, or sometimes that's the case. You can certainly find in media research examples and arguments made for precisely what you're arguing there, which is that the catharsis theory, the notion that by watching sports, we can somehow be less violent ourselves. You can also find ample evidence in the literature that the viewing of violence does heighten the aggression of viewers in all kinds of ways that's sort of manifest and studied in very particular nuanced settings. Now, your other point about whether or not this should change, I'm of the mindset, well, I should say first, I write this book with tremendous ambivalence, right? So I am critiquing and attacking some of the very same things in sports culture that I watch and devote myself to religiously. So I do not come at sports culture from the vantage point of someone who's not already knee-deep as a fan. Hmm. Now, I think the argument that I'm hoping to make is that for most of masculine history, the default setting has been one in which the ideal was for men to, in their ideal form, absorb pain and deliver violence to others. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'd like to see is a broadening of what is considered as acceptable masculinity, rather than there being one single version of masculinity, of which the NFL star has long been sort of the pinnacle of that. I think we're moving to an era where there are multiple and different forms of masculinity with different relationships to violence, with different relationships to stoicism, that I think does portend a very helpful trend in the culture, because I think a lot of that hypermasculinity and machoism has been deeply destructive over the years. Mm-hmm. It has been deeply entertaining to me as a football fan. Again, I don't want to make this sound like I'm not ambivalent or that I'm somehow outside this culture. But I think if you look at, say, the reaction to one of the most famous quarterbacks in the NFL, Andrew Luck, retiring, you saw in that a sensitivity from a lot of the media and a lot of his fellow players that you wouldn't have seen before. And I think that's a perfectly healthy thing for a guy who's gotten his body absolutely destroyed over the past decade in the NFL.
Yeah, Michael, I mean, I agree with all of what you just said. And to be clear, what is obvious is that there are many different versions today of what masculinity is. And many of them are gentle, and not violent. But we're talking here about that one specific, kind of ancient prototypical male thing of violence as a kind of warfare. And so the question is, if you think that that's evil, is it a necessary evil? I guess it's kind of two back-to-back questions. That's tricky. It's almost like hard to answer. It's one of those impossible things, because you can answer it both ways and be equally sure that you're right, I guess. But, let's kind of switch to a different thing a little bit. So I think sports clearly foster a strong sense of community and belonging among a team's fans. It's really tribal. And so that's a good thing in large part, and maybe has some bad aspects too when you get soccer hooligans or whatever, since most people like to watch a game live on TV, if they're not at the stadium or arena already, we're watching it live there, there's an immediacy that nearly all other media lack today. In other words, most people don't tape a game, although I do sometimes, but most people don't, who are really into it, don't tape a game and then watch it 6 hours later when they already probably know who won, right? So Your premise is that in the book is that tribalism brings us together. So that's a good thing, no?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, the book is half scathing critique and half romantic celebration. Yeah. And to that question that you posed, that very much falls on the side of the book that I'm deeply romantically in love with, frankly. I love that part of sports culture. I love the fact that sports tells us collectively what time it is. There are very few things in our contemporary media moment that tell us what time it is, because virtually everything can be consumed on your own time whenever you so desire. Virtually all other forms of entertainment, pop culture, the diversions, the movies, television that we watch, the music that we listen to, virtually all of that tends to happen at a moment of our own choosing. Sports is the last thing that you have to watch live. And I think that is precisely the thing that gives it such tremendous power. It's certainly the thing that gives it economic power. Hmm. Within the U.S., sports is estimated to be worth about $70 billion in terms of industry revenues. And I would submit that the vast majority of that wealth is derived from the fact that people have to consume sports live, which is precisely what advertisers need in our commercial-backed media system. So for me, the fact that sports can concentrate this amazing, vast psychic energy on what's unfolding before us right in the present moment, that is a beautiful thing. That is what creates community. That is what sustains people in the present moment. That is precisely what everyone who's doing yoga right now is hoping to achieve. You can get that same Zen-like focus on this present moment through the experience of watching and participating in sports. And for that, I give sports all the credit in the world.
Yeah, it's not just all the people who have gathered in your living room. I started to say all the guys in your living room. But anyway, it's all the other living rooms, and you may be calling them during the ads a little bit, or you may be tweeting them or whatever. And, you know, so there is this, even if you're not in the same room, there's this sense of millions of eyes focused on the same thing at the same time, which is unique, really. And, you know, you mentioned the ads. I mean, you know, unless you take a bathroom break or head into the kitchen to get a snack or something, you're going to watch the ads, and it's probably the last bastion of captive audience for advertisers. So, you know, the Super Bowl ads, for example, are famous because they're better than the halftime show. I mean, they're part of the entertainment a lot. And so how does that affect the ads in general and their content, the fact that the advertisers know there are so many eyes on their ads, which is such a rare thing now?
Yeah, well, it makes it a complete infestation of commercial colonization, I would say. I guess I'm mixing metaphors there. But the last place that people have to watch advertising is sports. As you say, you can get up, you can change the channel. But unlike most other forms of scripted or other TV programming, you're often liable to catch a brand message while you're watching sports, which means that there has been just an absolutely overwhelming tsunami of advertising that has infested the sports media landscape. Any space that a corporation can stick their logo in, they will do so. And I think that really is a sign of businesses and corporations and advertisers being panicked about how exactly you reach the consumer, how exactly you reach audiences nowadays for a commercial message. And it also testifies, again, to this notion of sports being extremely lucrative because it concentrates our attention. That's the most valuable commodity in today's economy, is your attention. And if you have the power to command that, then you have the power to charge really exorbitant rates to those brands who want to associate with it. And so you've seen, not just in sports, but in media in general, a creep from what used to be advertising content that stayed within the commercial break, and it's crept into the content itself. It's crept into product placement and branded content, and sports is one example of that.
Yeah, it's not just people wearing logos on their jerseys, but, you know, I mean, it's NASCAR with ads plastered all over the car, and, you know, it's stadiums named after companies, and, you know, even fishing shows, for example, I mean, which I seldom watch for this reason, that it's like half ad or more and half ad or less fishing. And even during the fishing show, the guy's showing the lure and saying, "Is this lure by so-and-so?" It's like, what? Come on, you know. The whole thing is just clearly and blatantly and grossly a vehicle for advertising, so I don't watch it for that reason.
Drives you crazy, right? I mean, it drives me crazy. I think it is. There's a strange fact of advertising, which is that, you know, it's constantly looking for empty spaces where other advertising isn't. And then when it finds an empty space, it fills it in, and it more or less kind of despoils this, you know, it sort of ruins the soil there for our attentiveness. And so there's a real irony in that regard.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Professor Michael Sarrazio, who is a professor of communications at Boston College. We're talking in particular about his book, The Power of Sports, Media and Spectacle in American Culture, which just came out a little while ago and is a very interesting book, you know, about culture. I don't usually do shows on sports, but it's more a book about the impact of sports in our culture and vice versa. So, you know, I'd ask you this question, too, to kind of switch subjects now away from ads. Do sports fill a spiritual as well as a social vacuum now? I mean, I'm thinking really about kind of the weakening of religion across our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And this also falls under the heading of romantic celebration in terms of my appreciation and my enthusiasm for sports culture. So if you look at some of the recent Pew research on religiosity in America today, what you find is a steady increase of those who are unaffiliated with any formal religion or do not identify as religious in any way. At this point, there's maybe 50 or 60 million Americans who have no religious affiliation. And that, as I say, that share kind of keeps growing in terms of the population. It's my argument that sports culture is the folk faith of our time. In other words, for those folks who are not getting their needs fulfilled from what religion had traditionally provided, they are finding many of the same gratifications in sports culture. And I think that's true in a couple of different ways. First of all, similar to religion, sports provides what I call totems that different tribes can organize themselves around. So your community, your identity is based upon sports and the object of your veneration, your favorite team, in the same way that religion used to do for many types of people. Mm-hmm. Sports also furnishes the language of belief, right? We're told that when our team stinks, and I'm a San Diego fan, my team's always stunk. We're told that, you know, we got to believe, right? We got to have hope, right? That's very much religious language. Sports provides us with feelings of moral judgment. My team is good. Your team is evil. My rival is evil. And so in that sense, I'm sort of arguing that sports kind of simulates this human experience that we long got as human beings from religion, even as more and more people over the years find themselves institutionally divorced from it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, to me in general, I often think of celebrities as replacing royalty. And so the sports, you know, the players, especially the star players, are celebrities. And so they kind of, they don't replace royalty so much as, you know, they become like religious figures or like priests in a certain way. I can see the parallel you're talking about between sports and religion. Well, another question then, how is the relationship between the teams and the players and the media, especially sports journalists, changed in recent years? I mean, it seems like the media are kind of fawning in a way a lot of times compared to other media who are more like on the skeptical slash attack mode with respect to their targets sometimes.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sports journalism and sports media is put in a very funny place because unlike other forms of journalism where the ideal of objectivity still reigns, sports journalism does not always abide by those same standards and ideals of objectivity, and it remains in question whether that's what fans even want, right? I mean, if you're, you know, here in Boston, if you're a reader of, say, the Boston Globe, do you want the Globe to cover, you know, for fans in Boston, the Red Sox and the Bruins and the Celtics and so on, do they want the Globe to cover those teams objectively? They're fans of those teams, right? They're rooting for those teams to win championships, which they often do. Do they actually want the media to cover sports in an objective way? The other challenge that the sports media faces is the fact that increasingly the subjects of media coverage are producing their own media themselves. This is true not just in sports. This is true across the spectrum of news, politics, business, etc. The ability for a sports team, the ability for an athlete, the ability for a politician, the ability for a corporation to simply bypass the media, to go around the gatekeeper and reach audiences directly is a broad trend that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years. That makes it extremely hard, again, for journalists to do their job because they understand that they are competing with the people that they cover to get news about those people and teams to the audiences that previously had to simply rely on journalists for the nature of that coverage. And so that becomes a real challenge. Sports journalists are put in a really tricky place. And all of this is happening, by the way, as the entire news industry is collapsing in slow motion in terms of revenues, layoffs, advertising funding, newspaper closures, etc. So it's a complicated, difficult time to be a sports journalist.
Yeah, it's tough. It's hard to compete for scoops with the person who's generating the scoop himself. So like within that then, Michael, how do female sports journalists fit into this picture? It must be even rougher for them. I mean, you know, starting with locker room access where you're walking into a room full of naked men and, you know, they're all like either super angry because they just lost and they think they've been screwed out of a few key calls, or they're exuberant because they won. I mean, it's basically maleness at its extreme one way or the other. And you're walking in going, hello. So what's that whole deal like?
It's extremely hard. And it's been hard for 4 decades. I had the pleasure of interviewing for the book about 50 or 60 different sports media folks and sports business folks. One of those was Leslie Visser. She's a pioneer in the world of sports journalism on behalf of, she was part of the first generation of female sports journalists. She gave me a funny example when she was interviewing Terry Bradshaw back in the 1970s when he was a quarterback for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and she tried to go up to him to get some quotes. She had her little reporter's notepad out, and he grabbed her pen and notepad and signed it for her, assuming that she was seeking an autograph.
Oh my gosh.
That same mentality, surprisingly and unfortunately, still persists today. Sports culture is deeply inhospitable to female journalists. If you look at just statistics, there are very few of them, right? More than 90% of sports media folks are male. And every time you find a female reporter who makes some sort of breakthrough in the sports media, she typically faces a kind of backlash against her. She's often evaluated based upon her looks in a way that her male sports journalist counterparts would never be evaluated.
Sure.
And often in trying to achieve some sort of attractiveness that's expected, she feels as though and is told that that calls into question her credibility. So she faces... You know, the female sports journalist faces a real double bind that she's had to navigate over the years. You do see, success stories. You do see breakthroughs. But, particularly on Twitter, it can get really ugly for female sports journalists.
Hmm. Yeah. And it seems like they're kind of sidelined, the field sideline role where they're in front of the bench interviewing somebody real quick and not doing the kind of more in-depth stuff. But yeah, like you say, it's a catch-22. You have to look good to keep your job, but the better you look, the less seriously you're taken. So right away, as you said, a double bind. Well, let's talk about for a moment about women's sports, which obviously take a distant back seat to men's sports in every arena, except, maybe beach volleyball or something you like. Right? Are there areas where that's changing and in what ways?
Well, yeah. So overall, it's been just as difficult for female athletes as female sports journalists. Male sports are covered overwhelmingly more than female sports. Usually the research tends to show about 2-3% of sports airtime and sports journalism is given over to women's athletics. That being said, I will say that the Women's World Cup this summer was another great sign of popularity, media prominence, fandom, coverage. I mean, you can see, I think, in women's soccer, a real opportunity to gain a foothold in popular culture in a way that you haven't seen before. And I think that's partly due to the sheer dominance of the team. I mean, they won their second straight World Cup, and they have a tremendously interesting, likable cast of characters that's on the team that always helps in terms of marketability. But also, I'd add that, in the U.S., soccer does not have the dominant status that other three major U.S. sports have.
That's right.
Where you kind of associate them with males playing them. Mm-hmm. And so there could be an opening there where soccer has not been gendered, for lack of a better word, within the kind of American fan imagination. And you could see some opportunity and some hope and some growth there.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as being similar to tennis, where I'd say there's somewhat parity between men and women in the tennis arena. But then again, it's not major advertising. It's not the central, American sport in a way. So there's that. But let's talk for a minute about, there's been a lot of focus lately on concussions in football. And you mentioned that earlier on chronic traumatic, let me try to say this right, encephalopathy, I think, anyway. Maybe I got that right. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
And, absolutely. That's why I usually just say CTE.
There you go. Right. No, but people don't know what, it sounds like a stock. I don't know.
Exactly.
And then, players quitting the game over it, as you mentioned. So that kind of gets at the core of whether the game's violence is worth the cost in the larger sense. But the flip side of that question is players make millions for playing a game they love and have been playing since they were 4 years old. So, I mean, maybe they don't know in most cases anything else to do really except play that game and make the money off of it. So what do you think about that thing? I mean, are they just our American gladiators and that's a thing they've chosen and that's their choice in life and they got to take the good with the bad?
Yeah. Well, you have two. I mean, it's a fascinating question and it's one that we don't quite have the answer for yet, but you have two trends or two patterns that are running in opposite directions. On one hand, the NFL is the most dominant institution of pop culture in America today. Its revenues are somewhere around $14 billion or so at this point. Commissioner Roger Goodell hopes to reach $25 billion by the middle part of the next decade. It is routinely the most watched single program in a given year. Networks are more or less, the broadcast networks are more or less on life support, financially speaking, because of the NFL. It's the last sort of thing that they can get people to tune in mass numbers. Now, the flip side of that is if you look at youth participation, you have seen a steady slide downward in terms of youth participation in football over the past decade. They just released some statistics in August, and I want to say that football participation among teens had dropped by something like 100,000. So, you know, the question will be, what will be football's ultimate fate? It's something that's tremendously popular. It's something that players can make tremendous amounts of money off of. Ownership certainly is. But if there's not a pipeline of young people sort of being funneled into it, that's going to reduce potentially the number of fans. It could certainly also reduce the talent available down the road. So football's at a complex moment. If it was a stock, I wouldn't say sell. I wouldn't say buy. I'd say football was a stock, I'd say hold, because I just don't know that we know yet how this is all going to play out. But the decline in youth participation is without a doubt directly related to parents' fears about the potential for concussions and subsequent CTE style brain damage. So, you know, this is kind of an open question going forward.
Yeah, so clearly parents are controlling the beginning of the pipeline, and no matter what choices kids might make later, they're already being set on a path by their parents. Well, you know, Michael, there are a number of other questions I'd like to ask you, but we are running short of time. So let me just go to one last kind of overarching question in just a minute or so. Realistically, do you think the role that organized sports play in our culture will change significantly anytime in the near future?
In the near future, no. In the near future, I think that sports will continue to dominate the American cultural landscape. It will perhaps slowly begin to falter in that status, and this will largely be driven by what happens with Generation Z. Do they play sports in the amounts that previous generations did? We're already seeing a decline, not just in football, but in sports participation overall among young people. And will they watch sports like previous generations did? And we're not seeing that either. They're cutting the cord. They're not watching long, four-hour-long games. That's simply not how they consume media content. So the fate of organized sports is, not surprisingly, like many things, in the hands of a younger generation coming up, and we'll just have to sort of watch and see how that shakes out.
Yeah, and if sports, particularly football, do kind of diminish in importance, it'll be interesting to see longer term, indirectly, how that affects our culture as a whole, you know, and do we continue, I think, as I said at the beginning, become more civilized, more feminized, and I don't know, that's a good thing in general. But anyway, we'll see what the overall impact of that is on our culture. Well, again, the book is The Power of Sports by Michael Serazio. His name is spelled Serazio. And as I said, it's an interesting read. And as you've been hearing, it's full of all kinds of topics. And, you know, the quotes with so many people are interesting to hear. I mean, it's really a tremendous amount of research went into it. It's available at all the usual outlets, you know, Amazon and everything. Well, Michael, Dr. Serazio, I appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you so much, Court, for having me. I hugely appreciate the time that you've taken and the really thoughtful discussion. I'm deeply appreciative on all fronts.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.